Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to a special Capital Conversations editions of the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleforum conference call as today, July 10th, 2020, we welcome the 70th U.S. Secretary of State, Michael Pompeo. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and General Counsel of the Federalist Society. Please note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will be transcribed. Also, all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. We're going to hold something of a conversation with the Secretary today in a special 30-minute Teleforum conference call. To begin, Secretary Pompeo, welcome. Thank you very, very much for being with us today. And please go right ahead with your opening thoughts.
Well, Dean, great. Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for joining me today. I'll be very brief, as I want to open it up for as much conversation and discussion as we had. I thought I'd mention just two things, that one of which occupies a lot of time and another one which we've been working on here for quite a while. The first is the challenge presented by a new model of communism and the Chinese Communist Party and the threat it poses to the United States. I'm sure we will talk about that some more. But the president and our team here at the State Department have been very focused not only on the challenges that it presents in the region and the risks that that creates to open commercial flow and our from a defense perspective, but also the larger global challenges that a relatively powerful 1.4 billion person nation directed by someone of the nature of General Secretary Xi presents to the fundamental understandings of the rule of law and sovereignty that President Trump has made the central pillar of our foreign policy. And so I'm happy to talk more about that. The second thing I wanted to mention is a project that we commenced now, goodness, almost 2 years ago, not long after I became the Secretary of State, something I've worked on and considered for a good part of my life, and that is how we more our understanding of human rights and the traditions of our founding documents, and then the impact that has on how we execute our foreign policy. And I set about creating a commission now a little over a year ago that has completed its work, or largely completed its work, and we will introduce its document next week, a week from yesterday, Thursday, at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. I'll make some remarks, and I hope your folks will take the time to read the work of the report and the statement that I make around them. If we can't get this piece right, and I see this at the State Department all the time, we have this enormous proliferation of this idea of rights, this language about things that are rights. And as they proliferate, it makes it more difficult to prioritize and to then deliver in improving the human rights conditions for people all across the world. And if we are not grounded here in our rights tradition with an understanding of our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution, we've certainly seen this play out over the last few weeks here in the United States. If we don't understand that central tradition of having our government with its primary focus of securing our freedoms, it's not possible for us to successfully deliver anything in terms of American capacity to be a force for good around the world and in creating opportunity for those freedoms to exist in countries all around the world. And with that, Dina, I'll conclude and take questions or thoughts from the folks who are on the call today.
Well, thank you, Secretary. Again, thank you. Thank you for being with us. I think we've been told by your staff that we're supposed to hold a conversation just between the two of us, so that's what we'll do unless you want to open it up to the floor.
I'm happy to open it up if you'd prefer to do that. I'm wide open. Easy.
Okay. All right. Well, let me ask you a question about the commission you just mentioned on inalienable rights, which I've sort of followed the work of the commission and read up on it a bit. And from some of the commentary I've read, it's this effort, without having produced a report yet, it's being anticipated and characterized by some as sort of anti-gay, anti-LGBT, anti-same-sex marriage. I want to give you a chance to respond to that. The reports I've read, they're all couched in language of if they do this, then this, or they might do this, or they could do this. It's all very speculative, but I wanted to give you a chance to respond to some of that speculation.
I appreciate that. We've seen this. We saw this from the moment we made the initial announcement. The traditional human rights organizations went round the bend thinking somehow that we would depart from what have been the traditional understandings of human rights, not only our Declaration of Independence or our Constitution, but the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as well. And indeed, what we were doing was just the opposite, trying to go reground, to go back to first principles. It's absolutely imperative that we do so. That set off lots of speculation. We've had many public meetings since then. We've been sued, I think, at least once, maybe multiple times in the course of us trying to just have a commission do some really good work in the report. And next week, we'll get to show America what the work of the commission was. I'm sure many people will agree with parts of it, disagree with other parts of the commission's work. I'm confident that none of the commission members agree with everything that will end up in the report either. But suffice it to say, if we get this right and we can deliver for my team, who's out in 180 plus places around the world every day, trying to improve America's capacity to preserve religious freedom, to protect basic and fundamental human rights. If we get that right, if we reground this, then I think we will have done a good turn for the world. I'm sure we'll be criticized by some. I'm sure some will say that we have abandoned the plethora of rights that have expanded over time. I think when people of good faith read the work that's been done by this commission, it's something that America can be truly proud of.
And the report you mentioned, I don't know if it's coming out on a date certain. You mentioned next week, so I will look for it then. Is it a policy paper? Does it talk about principles or policy or both? Can you talk about give us a little more insight into what to expect in that regard?
Yes, the charter that I provided to the commission was not to set foreign policy. It's not the commission's role to do that. I have an entire bureau, a human rights bureau here, that executes that. But it is not possible to set one's human rights foreign policy platform without a deep understanding of the principles that underlay it. And I think we had lost the bubble. I think we lost the fundamental moorings that had permitted us to have the firm foundation to go execute this mission across the world. And I'm hoping we reground this. This is about a set of principles, a set of deep understandings about the nature of rights, from where those rights flow, how we secure them here in the United States, and then how we should use our capacity around the world to improve the human rights conditions for people in a complex, difficult set of foreign policy contexts in multiple countries that each have different rights traditions, all the while making sure we remain our focus as preserving and securing those rights and freedoms for the American people, the task which I swore I would do when I took on this gig.
Yeah, and I don't know if you're acting as an ex officio member of the commission or not, but I'm wondering if you want to share your thoughts on, just say a little bit more about your thoughts on the founding of the United States and whether and how the Declaration of Independence is applicable in U.S. foreign policy. You've sort of touched on that, but I wonder if you want to go a little bit deeper on that.
So I'm not an ex officio member, which gives me the freedom to do that today. And I'll comment more on this when I make my remarks, which will be separate from the report itself. I believe that the Declaration of Independence is fundamental to understanding the American experiment, the project with which in which we have all been engaged, in which I try to put in a little bit better place each and every day that I come to work. Our founders, when they wrote that document, understood the nature of our rights, that each of us was created in God's image, and that our rights flowed from that fundamental understanding. They weren't granted by government, but rather government was created to secure those rights. And I think that understanding is central. We've seen others, now big institutions with lots of money, trying to make an argument that that is not, in fact, the central understanding of the American experiment. I think that is a dangerous path to go down for the traditions that we have in America that have created a truly exceptional nation now, 244 years on.
Any thoughts on the records of any countries in particular when it comes to respecting inalienable rights and their sort of understanding of inalienable rights and actions taken therefrom?
You know, Dean, maybe one way to think about this is more broadly than mentioning any specific nation. There are so many that one could go through where these universal rights are so sorely neglected. Certainly places like Nicaragua and Cuba, today China. The list is sadly too long. There is an important point to consider here. Sometimes the United States is accused of hypocrisy when we travel the world and talk about these things, because, in fact, we don't get it right every day here. We are imperfect, and we strive to become a more perfect union every day. But it is dangerous and intentional when people compare the United States and our efforts to preserve those rights to these other non-human rights-respecting countries. There is no moral equivalence between the two, and our capacity for self-reflection and improvement is the hallmark of demonstrating the difference between how it is that the United States strives to protect and secure those rights for its people and how these nations that do not choose to respect human rights act and behave with respect to their people. There's no recourse. There's no recrimination. There's no improvement. It is simply improper to compare a human rights failure that occurs here in the United States with one that occurs in many of these nations that are not rights respecting. I think that's an important framework for everyone to understand. And indeed, the commission's report, I think, will address this as well.
Let me ask you one other question, if I could, about the report, and then maybe a question about China, and then if we have some time, I'll open it up to the floor. But these are, you know, pretty complicated issues with, you know, potential implications for international and foreign policy. Is there anything you mentioned that the rank and file listeners here can do to further the cause? You mentioned paying attention to the report when it comes out, reading it, actually going to the original source document rather than maybe relying on characterizations by the press. Beyond that, what else can our listeners do?
Look, that would be most useful. We're also going to – the State Department's going to spend time after this to get in front of different groups and articulate not only what's contained in the report but the why this matters. And then I know lots of folks who are members of your organization have been in government or will be in government again. And I think it's incredibly powerful as they interact with government leaders, whether that's government leaders here in the United States or leaders from around the world, not just people who are formally part of their nation's leadership structure, but commercial actors, lawyers, all those people who are engaged in enterprises that have real impact on the rights understandings around the world. I hope that they will take on board some of the work that the commission did and then help reinforce it to the extent they're in agreement with the conclusions that the commission has reached about how it is we should think about rights in the United States and then how it is we should take our rights tradition and try and improve the lot for people around the world as well.
Very good. I do have one question I'm interested in asking about China in particular, but let me defer, and if you're amenable, we'll open the floor to questions.
Yes, sir, of course.
We've got quite a few callers and quite a few questions, so at least a half dozen questions to begin. I'm going to ask our callers to be as concise as possible in respect to the time here. We've got 15 minutes left to hard stop at 12.
And I'll do the same, Dean.
Okay. Well, you can go on as long as you like, but we got a caller from Washington. Go right ahead, caller.
Yes, thank you. You, Attorney General Barr, and President Trump at Mount Rushmore have been the outstanding spokesman of the law and religious liberty in my lifetime, and I want to express thanks for that. A quick question. Many of us are skilled lawyers. Many of us are skilled litigators. The federal government is engaged in a war with China, a Cold War. What parts of the federal government do skilled litigators need to go to participate?
That's a great question. So we'll always take skilled, solid, constitution-breathing lawyers here at the State Department. There is, to your point, with respect to the Chinese Communist Party, there is a significant element of this Cold War that you described. There is a significant element of it that is a legal battle. So there's lawfare being engaged in across multiple fronts. I could spend an awful lot of time talking about it. It is both of interest to me as someone who has a law degree as well, but importantly, significant in how we compete, whether this is about legal claims in the South China Sea or legal claims at international institutions all across the world. There is a real role there. And of course, we see this in environmental issues as well. There are many good places for talented, skilled lawyers to go to execute their profession and deliver good outcomes for the United States.
Thank you.
Secretary, it's Dean. One thing you've mentioned, lawfare, one thing that's been on the mind of a lot of our members and practice group leaders is, I would describe it as the weaponization of a country's antitrust or IP regimes to the advantage of wholly owned government corporations, or at least partially owned government corporations. And at a level of detail deeper, a complaint that our agencies, in some respects, are not setting good examples. Now, I don't want to turn you on other American agencies, but I wonder if you want to respond to that at all. Or is there coordination between our foreign policy efforts and our trade efforts and domestic agencies that are in charge of enforcement?
Dean, I may take a pass on this other than to say this, we do our best to coordinate the risks that you have identified there, that concern about how other nations are using their intellectual property laws to prevent real competition is real. President Trump's actually recognized this in a way I think previous administrations have refused to take on. You see the same kind of things happen in the religious freedom space where they truly use particular legal structures to accomplish ends which aren't directly related to their stated objective. We try our best to coordinate. We don't always get it right, but we're better at it today than we were even just a couple years ago.
Very good. We got about 12 minutes left, still a handful of questions, so let's check in with another caller.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kimberly Lewis. It is an honor and a pleasure to talk to you, sir. As an ex officio emerita of my law school's Federalist Society, one major question for you, sir. The floor was opened up with LGBTQ rights. Chechnya has a really, really, really problem of how they treat gays and lesbians in that country. I've noticed that the Trump administration, which I am a supporter of and a supporter of you also, sir, for the work that you've done, has not really issued visas for people from that part of the world coming here to the United States to be relieved of some of the grievances and the egregious punishment that's going on towards them. Is there anything that we are doing to help people in that part of the world come to the United States via visa program?
So it's an important question. I do not know the answer with respect to that particular country or region. I will do my best to get you an answer. Thanks for giving me your name, and if you're willing, we'll make sure and get a formal response to you. But if I raise up just one more level, there are many nations around the world that treat LGBTQ people in ways that are deeply inconsistent with what it is. You'll see in the Commission on Inalienable Rights report, right, the protection of those fundamental unalienable rights. We see this in lots of nations in the world. It is often part of our diplomatic effort to address that and confront it. We have lots of issues in many of these countries, some of them are cross-cutting. But make no mistake, President Trump has given real guidance to our team to do all that we can to make sure that the criminalization of that in countries around the world is something that the United States is very clear and unambiguous about, that is, in fact, unacceptable.
Very good. Let's move on to our next caller.
Hi, yeah. Mr. Secretary. Thanks a lot. 2 years ago, you wrote an article explaining the religious persecution in Iran and China. And I was just wondering, you know, given the increasing attention that this administration has directed toward those activities, how do you anticipate us moving forward, and do you anticipate, you know, the Trump administration making it a, you know, bigger focal point of his administration entering the election and going forward?
Well, I can't speak to what the campaign may do. With respect to religious freedom, I'm truly proud of what we've done. Ambassador Brownback, who I've known from my days back in Kansas, and our team have made a real priority promoting religious freedom on virtually every trip that I take. I meet with religious leaders around the world. I meet with those who have suffered from religious persecution. When I was in Central Asia, I met with Uyghur families who had either currently or previously had some of their family members held in the most awful conditions one can imagine in Western China. It has truly been a priority for President Trump and our team. We've built out something that we pray will be lasting. We conduct an annual event here at the State Department that is the largest diplomatic event that we do every year, where we bring religious leaders from all around the world of all faiths to talk about religious freedom and how they can build institutions inside of their countries that preserve it. And then we try and connect it up for them that having a an open space for religious freedom and people to exercise their own conscience actually makes their government more stable and improves the lives of their peoples in ways that are important to their leadership or to their regime. I hope we will continue to pursue that for the next 6 months until the new administration comes in. And then I hope, whether it's President Trump continuing or Vice President Biden, that they will continue this work. It is important work for the State Department to be engaged in, to work around the world to promote religious freedom wherever we can.
We'll continue to work through our questions. We still have a half dozen left, but we might get to all of them. But go right ahead. Caller from area code 678.
Yeah. My name is Sang Min Nam of Radio Free Asia. Yesterday, the North Korean leader's sister say another summit between U.S. and DPRK is unlikely. So I want to know your reaction and then what you think about possibility have a summit between U.S. and DPRK before press election this November.
Well, we're now 100-some days out from the election. We have continued. I saw the remarks from Kim Jong-jol this morning. I know that we are trying to continue to have dialogue to try and keep the discussion that began when I first went to Pyongyang myself back in April of 2018. We've had an ongoing conversation since then. Twice the leaders of the two countries have met. We only value the summits when there's a possibility that we can do something that's significant. We achieved that in Singapore by getting at least the outlines of a central understanding. In Hanoi, we weren't able to make as much progress, but it doesn't make sense to put the two leaders together unless there's substantial opportunity to make progress on the core problem set of North Korea denuclearizing and creating peace and stability on the peninsula. Whether that'll happen in the next 100-plus days or not, I don't know. We're always open to that possibility.
Very good. Head to our next caller, area code 949. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi, Secretary Pompeo. My name is Taylor, and I'm an undergrad at UCLA. And I just want to say this is really exciting. It's such an honor. But I wanted to ask
Go Bruins. I grew up in Southern California, and my son went to UCLA
there we
as
go.
Well.
There we go. I wanted to ask you about the New START treaty. I know that Trump is set on trying to bring China into this key nuclear deal with Russia, but given China's relatively minimalist nuclear posture and its low state of nuclear readiness, I know this is seemingly unlikely. So I wanted to ask, what steps is the Trump administration taking to get China onto this deal? And do you think that the coronavirus would at all affect China's decision?
No, I don't think I don't think the virus will impact their decision. I think they're going to make a strategic decision based on their calculus about whether it's in their own country's best interest to participate in the strategic dialogue alongside us and the Russians. You know, they made an interesting statement from China yesterday that suggested that they were at least open to some form of dialogue. They set a condition for entry into the conversation that was a pretty high bar, and we have responded to that. But our view is very clear. We have a set of historic arms control discussions and strategic dialogues that had historically in the 80s and in the 90s involved two nations, the United States and the Soviet Union, and then Russia. It is no longer the case that you can get a comprehensive strategic outcome that reduces risk of a nuclear confrontation absent a nation like China that has such a significant nuclear capability. And so they claim they want to be part of the international firmament. They claim they want to comply with the norms that great powers achieve. They ought to sit down and be part of this conversation about how it is we achieve a strategic outcome that reduces risk for the world that any nation would ever actually use their nuclear weapons. And then you'd asked, too, at the beginning about New START. That conversation is ongoing. I think our team was on the ground in Vienna. They may have finished up early this morning, our time, having what would be the third conversation with the Russians about how we can move forward together and reduce risk, even with just two of us having the conversation. But we've made it clear to the Russians that it is important that they too lend their hand in convincing the Chinese Communist Party that it is in the Chinese Communist Party's best interest to participate in these discussions. They are important nuclear country, and we need them to be part of this conversation.
We've got just about 2 minutes left. Let's see if we can squeeze in a final question. I'll ask the caller to be as brief as possible. Go right ahead, caller.
Secretary Pompeo, I'm curious, with the current events daily basis. If you look at certain media outlets, you think that the rest of the world thinks that we've lost what we had at the founding. Can you just give us a little bit of insight? Is that truly what's going on, or do most leaders still respect us for our religious freedom and our adherence to unalienable rights? Thank you.
I read the stories of the decline of America with a small chuckle, in that my optic as America's Secretary of State is that wherever I go, I show up, a wonderful airplane that you all provide for me, and everybody wants to see America's Secretary of State. It's not Mike. They want to see the Secretary of State for the United States of America, as they recognize that we are in all of our efforts a force for good, trying to make things better for the entire world. When we compete around the world, we try to do so on a basis that is fair and transparent and reasonable. When we are forced to engage in kinetic activity, we do so only for the ends of reducing risk either to the nation which is taking place or defending our own country. I think nearly every leader in the world recognizes that, although many of them might not say so publicly. My observation is they still understand that we are, in fact, a beacon of freedom around the world. And not every nation, not every regime wants to follow that path. But those who do recognize that it is important to have a deep and a robust relationship with the United States of America. And so these stories of nations around the world deciding somehow that the United States is no longer a valuable partner are patently false.
Well, Secretary, this is Dean again. It is truly an honor to have the U.S. Secretary of State on our humble Teleforum conference call. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to have to leave some questions pending. Maybe we can have you back in the future sometime at your convenience.
I would welcome that, Dean. Yeah. Thank you all. Thanks, everyone, for joining me today. Everybody stay safe and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you so much, sir. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.